All right, welcome into the latest edition of That's So Cincinnati podcast. Another big episode.
Huge.
Huge. Jason Williams here with me as always. I'm Paul Leonard Jr. We are here. Team Inquirer, Cincinnati.com. Support local journalism.
Number one.
A lot to get to on this week's episode. One that we've been talking about. If you have been kind of following along, listening last week, we told you that the next 2 weeks we had some really nice guests that we were really excited about. And today we're going to have local Congressman Brad Wenstrup. And he has an insanely interesting background. And so there's a lot to get to with him. We're not really here to get too political with it, but I just think, you know, you talk about That's So Cincinnati, his background, St. X, UC, podiatrist here for 26 years, ran for mayor, and now he's representing everyone in DC. His backstory is wild.
And that was the thing with bringing him in today, is that we wanted to sort of show the human side of him. He's a 60-year-old doctor who later in life got married and after a long career in medicine, went into Congress and politics and adopted a little girl last year. And there's a lot there that we want to get into and 60, looking forward to
60
it.
60 years old, two kids under five, a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old. At age 39, called up the Army Reserves and said, I want to be part of this. I mean, his story is just, it's a wow. So I'm really excited to have Brad on. We're going to talk with him about a wide range of things. In the meantime, there's a lot going on locally. We love talking about transportation around here. I feel like we do a lot, mostly so you can get your streetcar digs in.
Our readers love the transportation coverage.
They do.
Having covered that beat.
Yeah. And there is, so we brought Hannah Sparling in today. She's busy. You are busy.
I am so busy.
You're number
so busy.
One in your program, number one in your heart.
Yeah. Number one.
Hannah Sparling. Welcome in.
Thank you.
Well, there's been a lot going on. I came up to your desk today, like, I want to talk about landslides. I'm super interested in this. This has been going on, and anybody that has sat either in backed up traffic on Columbia Parkway or even on backed up traffic on 71 because everyone's trying to avoid Columbia Parkway because it's shut down because of landslides. This is becoming a pretty big problem. Is there more of it happening? What is going on, and why is this happening?
It sure seems like there's a lot more of it happening. Part of the problem, and I'm not the landslide reporter. It turns out we don't have one of those.
No.
So I just...
We need to get one.
We do need to get one.
You and Terry DeMio did a really strong piece on the landslides. A couple weeks ago?
It was a couple weeks ago. Yeah, we just looked at just the huge impact it's having.
You guys are as much
here.
Of an expert on this as anyone in Cincinnati. So
it's fascinating though. So one of the problems though with that reporting that I ran into was nobody's really tracking it. So we don't, everyone says anecdotally, yeah, there's a lot more now, but no one can say we went from X to Y.
That's wild. You would think that would be something that the city would have a grasp on. I mean, something that affects so many people, that affects traffic so greatly. I mean, you would think that type of stuff would be an obvious thing to
the city has a number, but when you look at it, it was like, this is wrong. It's a number of issues they've fixed on streets, I think. But I mean, this is happening in people's backyards. It's just happening everywhere, and nobody's counting like the totality.
Well,
of everyone being impacted.
You know, being one of the hilliest metropolitan, you know, big cities in America, it's great that you're bringing light to this because it seems like a major problem.
It's a huge problem. And this is such a pretty city, but I mean, it's devastating. The things that landslide. Yeah,
this is sort of under the covers, the dark side of these beautiful hills.
Yeah. And I think like the thing that really stuck out to me was that it's not insured. So when you buy a house, for me, it's my biggest investment, and I'm on a slight hill, so I'm constantly afraid now.
Yep.
But it's just not, I mean, you call your insurance company thinking, yeah, this is going to suck, but they'll take care of it. But you're on your own.
That's that's the thing that is really affected the most, right? Is these people that have these houses that are just at a total loss, right? I mean, that's it.
Sometimes your value goes from $400,000 to zero, and you can't sell that. No one's going to buy it.
That's incredible. And it's not just, I think the ones on Columbia Parkway, have gotten a lot of press because of what they do to traffic or whatever, but there's more than that. They're everywhere. You talk about there were some in Avondale also causing.
Yeah, there's some in Avondale. I live in Bellevue and 39 of my neighbors are caught up in kind of like a little group landslide. And Bellevue doesn't have that many people, like 6,000. Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of everywhere. When I started reporting, I thought it would be really difficult to find, people to tell their stories, but they're just everywhere.
Yeah. It's incredible. So what now, council is approaching this topic, right? I mean, this is something that they're trying.
They're taking it pretty
serious.
Christopher Smitherman in particular has kind of been pushing. They want Columbia Parkway to be fixed because this is happening. It feels like every week.
Yeah.
Now it's shut down for a day or 2 days. So they want to fix that. I think a new retaining wall for that would be around $10 million, which is not cheap, but I think they're going to find a way to do it. And he also, I talked to him yesterday and he talked about finding some kind of fund to help homeowners so you're not just on your own.
Well, I mean, what's the sense that you're getting, Hannah, from City Hall? Is this just talk because it's now, because you've brought this to light? Do you think they're being serious about it or they're just giving lip service to, oh yeah, let's really try to do something here?
I think they're being serious. And I think part of that is because I do think it's happening more. I think, and a lot of scientists have told me it will happen even more with global warming. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be hard for you to be a person here much longer that doesn't know someone who's really impacted by this. And that will go for our city council members as well. So when they see people really struggling, you want to help.
Yeah, this is hard work. It's expensive.
It's so expensive.
Here's hoping that City Hall will really stay the course and try to find it. And this is a year where they're facing a $20 million budget deficit, so that's going to make it even extra challenging. Mm-hmm.
This is a good chance to move forward from a lot of stuff that we've been talking about the last few weeks. It's a perfect topic to say something that's important, something that's really affecting people. Everybody needs to be able to work together and get beyond the garbage that has gone on and do stuff about things like this.
Exactly.
This seems like a really good opportunity to get something done about something that really is affecting people.
But not only is it affecting homeowners, this is potentially, it affects, our commutes and our traffic flow as well.
Oh, yeah,
as we've had to shut down Columbia Parkway a lot here recently, right?
Yeah, it's been, I haven't counted how many times it's been, but it's been regularly shut down.
I would also think it has to be a safety concern. And
yeah, I think so. I mean, if you're driving along and all of a sudden there's a bunch of mud in the road, and Columbia Parkway is not a road with wide margins
by any means.
There's nowhere to go.
Is there a road that makes you more nervous than Columbia Parkway? There is no place that I drive in this city where I am more like, okay, 10 and 2, let's just make sure I just go ahead and say. I mean, it is an absolute nerve-wracking experience. And now you throw this into it and you're waiting because people think of landslides as like an avalanche, right? Like you see these videos. That's not exactly what's happening.
It's not. It's more of a slow terribleness that it oozes down the hill destroy you.
Comical disaster, and in the fact that it's so slow.
Yeah, it's like you see it coming, but you can't stop it.
You can't stop it
because having used to live on the east side, and it's a major commuter route, Columbia Parkway, Route 50, and you'll see at spots that where there's mud that's just kind of setting, where it's like they just stopped it and it's just kind of sitting on top of the wall. And it's like, if that fell over, that's going to fall right on top of the car.
Guys, do you think that's going to hold? No,
right.
I don't.
Can I also talk to you about shorter green lights?
You can. Yes.
So I come from a family. My father famously loves traffic patterns. And and like anytime we would drive somewhere, he's always talking about how the lights are just not timed up correctly. And it's so I feel like I'm always.
So boring.
I've inherited this. I've inherited this where I'm always like judging how
it sounds like a dad thing.
It's a very much a dad thing. But so this traffic study came out about downtown and it talks about the need for shorter green lights, rideshare zones, streetcar signals. How quickly is this going to, is this just recommendation? What is the status
of this? This is just, think of it like a landslide, very slow.
Very slow, right.
So this study actually hasn't even been presented to council yet. The presentation's just been uploaded. But so they're looking at shorter green lights for cars, longer for people. That's so the cars will stop hitting the people, which is happening all the time, especially downtown. Some rideshare zone, so people are picking up, dropping off in the same places. That lets traffic flow a little easier. It's just little things like that. They're also looking at streetcar timing, I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Giving some signal priority to the streetcar, and I think they're looking at four spots, and that would cost about $80,000. But it's not things that are going to happen tomorrow or this week. Some of it requires council approval. It's more money.
Have they been waiting on this study for a while?
I think for a million years.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like I've heard about this a lot, about the study that everyone's been waiting on forever.
And I got a loaded question for you.
Oh, please.
Are you tired of the streetcar?
See, I'm not a columnist. I'm a reporter.
You can be honest. It's a thing. It's an object.
I get tired of the pettiness that comes with the streetcar, certainly.
From you, mostly.
Mostly from Jason, yes.
Hey, I'm just the messenger.
It's exhausting.
I've never seen,
in a word.
I think I've said this on the podcast. I don't want to get too far off on a tangent here. But have you ever seen people get so worked up about an inanimate object than they do about the streetcar?
I have rarely seen you get so worked up about an inanimate object.
No, I'm talking about the supporters and the opponents.
You know it moves, right? Have you
sometimes written? A moving inanimate object?
Blockages are down.
I don't know. I find that stuff very so it's not going to happen. Nothing's going to happen downtown very soon.
I do think the first thing that will happen, based on the limited information I've seen, is changing that signal timing.
Gotcha.
So more time for walkers, less for cars. I don't know if that makes you happy or angry, but one of the two.
Everything makes me happy.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, I mean, transportation is a big topic. We talk about it all the time here because it's a big issue here in the city. I mean, it affects people, but not only that, just there's just so many ways that it's not as efficient as it needs to be around here that it seems like it's always coming up. It needs to be coming up. We haven't even talked about the viaduct yet.
No, we haven't.
Which
it's
usually,
a fascinating. Here's why I think transportation, like our readers are so into it, as Hannah knows. But I think when you think about our airport, we have two states here with a bridge, with all these bridges and a river that's owned by Kentucky, and Ohio wants to have control over it. Our airport's in northern Kentucky, and yet it serves mostly the Ohio side of the river. You have all these hills, and so how that affects your transportation system. It's not Columbus or Indianapolis where it's just pretty basic street grids. And so it's just a fascinating topic here that I think people are very interested in.
I agree. I don't know.
And I'm happy that I can be employed by doing it. You know what I mean?
Let's keep it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Hannah, thank you so much for coming on and joining us. There's so much to talk about with this. And hopefully the landslides maybe move slow, but hopefully City Hall will move fast. You like that?
What a way to end.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I'm skeptical about whether it'll happen.
All right, let's move on. Let's get to Brad Wenstrup here on That's a Cincinnati. So thanks again to Hannah for joining us. And so now here is our conversation with Congressman Brad Wenstrup. All right, interview time now on That's a Cincinnati, and I'm excited. We've been talking about this one for a few weeks, Jason, and we are lucky enough to have Congressman Brad Wenstrup come in and join us. You know, I could take time running down your resume. It's extensive. I won't do that. But you're my congressman, so thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Well.
A lot of people don't know your district, the second district. It runs from East Side Cincinnati all the way out to Portsmouth.
Correct.
So it's a large area that you cover,
even out to Chillicothe.
Yeah, well, Chillicothe is closer than Portsmouth.
Oh, it is.
So,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But it's a little bit further north, and a lot of time on the road.
Yeah, a lot of time, which is actually what I wanted to open to ask you about, because you have two kids. You have your son Brad, who's five, and your daughter Sophia, who is one, and then your wife Monica. And the four of you drive to Washington.
We do.
You do it every week?
Not every week, but most weeks. If there's a short weekend where we finish in session, say on Friday, and we're back on Monday, I might just come home and do a couple events and go right back. But otherwise, if it's 4 days, whatever, whenever we can, then we drive back and forth. And it's been really fun. The kids are pretty good in the car. Sophia, a little rowdy the last time, but my son, it's great because I got him hooked on old Andy Griffith shows.
Really?
And he asked for that. He goes, put on Andy Griffith. He loves Barney Fife. He loves Opie. And you can't beat it. And I got no complaints with him wanting to watch that.
What was the, I love this story because it's, I think you told me that, number one, thanks for coming in. We rarely have elected officials on the podcast, but you know, you and I have gotten to know each other, and I think there's a great, you know, you have a lot of things people don't know about you, your personal side, and this is one of them. How did the idea come about for you guys to drive back and forth? Was it also though that, hey, this is a chance you can spend time with your family?
I mean, and that has been our priority. I mean, this job is difficult because it's not only travel back and forth to Washington, but you are expected to go places, especially serving on intelligence committee. They are not vacation spots. I promise you that. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to places where most people don't want to go. But it's a requirement of that particular committee, which I'm honored to serve on. So there's a lot of time away. Now, our budget, you have to stay within your budget as a member of Congress. You go over it, it comes out of your pocket. Mm-hmm. And I can cover my transportation back and forth, but I can't cover my wife or my children. And we were affording it as best we could, flying until my son was born. And not really when he was born, but when he turned two. So when he turned two, it was like, all right, this is breaking the budget. That's just too much to pay this, you know, every time. So let's start driving. And we didn't mind it. We actually have always been able to do it with one stop, which is incredible.
One stop. Even with Sophia now.
Yeah. We go in, there's usually a McDonald's or Subway associated with the Loves. So you fill up the gas, you do the diaper change and get something to eat and drive on.
How long is that?
It's an 8-hour drive from Cincinnati, right?
That's a lot of car time.
I'm gonna have to have you talk to my wife because she wants to stop when we go to South Carolina. She wants to stop like 3 or 4 times. I'm like, yeah, we can do this straight, you know, just a couple stops. Anyway.
Yep. Well, we got them trained now, I think. So.
You mentioned we were talking about Sophia, and she's how old is she? You adopted her last year.
Right. So we adopted her 4 months old. She's now 17 months old, and she's got a big brother who just loves having her there and makes over her. And, you know, he wants to be the protector, of course. But I think she's doing pretty well protecting herself. She's feisty.
Talk about the story of what moved you and Monica to adopt, and how did that all come about?
Well, my wife is one of 6 children. I'm one of 5, and we got married late in life. And when we got married, truthfully, we didn't know if we'd, you know, physically be able to have children, but we were very blessed. Got pregnant right away, almost right away, and perfectly healthy pregnancy, and had my son. And after that, you know, we're used to siblings, you know, for the kids, and we thought we want to go that route. And we had no problem with the idea of adoption. Matter of fact, if we couldn't have kids, we were going to consider that anyway. So we went through the process, and it kind of given up at times. Unfortunately, twice we had a mother that chose us, and during the pregnancy, she lost the child. Mm. But then we literally got a call and said, how about a 4-month-old? And we said, we're fine with that. We came home from D.C., and we met with the birth mother, and she chose us and went back the next week with the car. Fortunately, we do drive because the car was filled with a crib and everything else.
Yeah.
And brought home our new daughter, and it's been wonderful.
It's just, she's from here, not
correct.
Okay.
She's from
you guys
Ohio.
Adopt her here in Ohio. Okay.
All right.
You know, I mean, you're a Cincinnati guy. Mm-hmm. You St. X, UC, grew up here. You know, where'd you go to school is your high school. I mean, you're you know, you grew up here. You've had a residence here, 26 years of optometrist here.
Correct.
In Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And I just, what is the city, you know, what has it meant to you, and why did you decide to go this? Why did politics speak to you? Because you went that direction, you know, later on. I mean,
right.
26 years where you have a whole different career. Why did it speak to you? And what is it, something about the city that pushed you that direction?
Well, I love the city. When I was doing all my medical training in Chicago, my roommates were from Iowa, and they go, we know Cincinnati's the center of the universe, you know, because I always talked about Cincinnati in that way. And in a lot of ways, it was the center of my universe for sure. I never intended to be into politics and going that route. Things just kind of happen. I'm one of those that if a door looks open, I'll at least look in and sometimes go in. I knew at a young age I wanted to be a doctor, but I always embraced those that served in the military. I had great respect for that. And during the first Gulf War, a couple local doctors deployed, and I thought I could do that. And so in 98, I just called 1-800-USA-ARMY and said I'd like to join because we kept getting attacked. And I thought, we got to go somewhere, I'll go. Well, that came up 2005, 2006. I served as chief of surgery at Abu Ghraib Prison Hospital. So we were not only treating our troops, but the enemy. And that just had a major influence on me. Come back, you know, I tell people it was the worst thing I ever had to do, but the best thing I ever got to do because of the people that I served with. And I just came back with a desire to want to do more. You know, you see the world through a different lens when you go through something like that for a year. And an interesting Cincinnati story. You have a 2-week crossover with the combat support hospital you're replacing. So the surgeon that I was replacing, I'm working with him for about a week, and then somebody asked me where I was from, and I said, Cincinnati. He was active duty, and he said, well, so am I. I said, well, I got to ask, where'd you go to high school? He said, Elder. I said, okay, well, I want to say next. Here we go. And as he said, that was the best week of his deployment. We really had a nice time together. But it was after that I started to get a little bit more involved. Locally, I literally got talked into running for mayor of Cincinnati against Mark Mallory. They enticed me with such things as like, you'll do great if you get 35%. But I looked at it as, you know what? I'm going to meet a lot of people. And we had a nice clean race. And actually afterwards, Mark Mallory appointed me to the Cincinnati Board of Health. And a lot of people had been hearing me speak at different events, you know, from Rotary to Kiwanis to churches to Memorial Day, Veterans Day, and said, you ought to run for office. I thought, well, you know, I got an experience as running a business, experience in healthcare, experience in the military. I think that's what our founders had in mind, is that you do something and then you serve. And I tell young people that. They'll say, oh, I want to be in Congress someday. What should I do? And I say, something else.
Yeah.
First.
Right.
Yeah. Do something else first, because then you bring an experience and you're weighing in on American lives and what they're going through every day. You should know what they're going through every day. It would be helpful.
You mentioned your work in the Abu Ghraib.
Mm-hmm.
So you've treated the enemy like literally?
That was our mission, that and to win over the hearts and minds of people that didn't know us. And I'd say by and large we did. But it was an interesting mission because we were responsible for the care of Saddam Hussein. I operated on Chemical Ali, the man who killed, 180,000 Kurds or some tremendous number like that.
You were operating on this guy to keep him alive.
To help him, got him better.
What was that like? I mean,
you know, most people were very grateful for the care. And I will tell you, one time one of the detainees said to one of the nurses, you all are the angels of mercy in here, and people know that now. But when you grow up thinking every problem you have is a result of because of America or Americans, you've never seen the other side. Your access to the world is very limited. And so you never saw the other side of what America is all about. And you think about it, there's not many military that do what we do when it comes to taking care of the enemy. And think of our young troops that are getting shot at, this and that, and then they fight back and wound somebody, then they pick them up and get them into care. But that is how you win over the hearts and minds of others. And we had the opportunity in that experience to take care of people in the area and little kids. One of our interpreters came in one day with some labs, and he said, can you help my daughter? She's 4 months old, and the doctors in Baghdad don't know what to do with her. And they sent her home to die. She's got diarrhea. She's vomiting. She's coughing. He showed me labs. I said, well, her kidneys are shutting down. She's got an infection. I went to the commander. He went to the general. They said, bring her in. So we bring her in. and we get an x-ray. She does have pneumonia. Anesthesiologist calls his wife at home, who's a pediatrician, and said, what antibiotic do you recommend? She's 4 months old. We get that going. We were able to start an IV on her. She was nothing more than a shadow on a wall. We gather together and such, well, she may be just failing to thrive, rejecting her mother's milk. She may have something called celiac sprue, where that's the case. And then we realize, oh my gosh, we don't even have formula here. We're a combat support hospital. No, we don't have baby formula. We pass the hat around. In a half hour, we had $300. The dad goes into Baghdad, gets the gluten-free baby formula. That's what she needed. And she survived.
Wow.
And she, and every week or so, we got a shipment from an American company because they heard of the story and they sent over gluten-free baby formula.
Wow. Is this part of the Iraqi charity that you're involved in a charity?
What we did was, while we were there also, one time I was talking to my sister and she said, what do you need? I said, nothing. I wear the same clothes every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're fed, but the people here have nothing. So we started this program called Operation Goodwill Gifts, and people from Cincinnati and all around would send over hygiene products, clothing, school supplies, toys. And we were able to get these out to the community. And we told them, these aren't from the U.S. government. These are from the American people that, you know, are wishing you goodwill. Mm-hmm. And it was just fascinating. You know, our kids have all these electronics and everything else. We got a shipment of yo-yos and they were fascinated by it. You know, and you're showing them how to use a yo-yo. Yeah. So we called that Operation Goodwill Gifts. And honestly, we'd get 20 boxes or so a week in the mail from people sending
things still going?
Over. No, it was just during our deployment. Yeah.
Nice.
From people in Cincinnati who knew I was over there.
And I mean, you're still active duty, right?
Active reserve.
Yeah. But you've also, I mean, this is a big part of your life, your service in the military, your service in Iraq. You're to this day still helping Iraqis, who come to the country legally and get visas, right?
Well, yeah, I'm really a proponent of expanding and making sure we're employing our special immigrant visa. You know, you got to keep in mind, like interpreters that worked for us, they put their lives on the line. When I was there, we lost two of our interpreters because they would leave us to go see their family and people would try to gun them down. And so one of the interpreters that I worked with got a Fulbright scholarship. So he was leaving around the time that we were leaving. He went to Emory University, got a master's in public health. I came home and said, you ever heard of Thanksgiving? You want to come up to Cincinnati? And he came in for Thanksgiving. And we've stayed in close contact since that time. He went back, got married, had his kids. He got his MD, USMD license, did a fellowship at Johns Hopkins in cardiology. He's now a cardiologist at Ohio State University and a U.S.
Wow.
citizen, as are his family.
That's awesome.
Another one who happened to be actually his brother-in-law was identified by someone 6 years later. And he contacted me, said, you know, I wanted to stay here, but we need to leave. They tried to kill my family. We're in hiding. So I wasn't in Congress then, but I signed for him from the military side. When I got in Congress, I called in some immigration people and said, what's holding this up? And he's here now doing family practice in Texas. Hmm. These are great stories.
Yeah.
Great, and they're great Americans now.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, you still see patients at Walter Reed. I mean, now, I mean, even, I mean, that's something that you wanted to keep doing, or was there an option to do that or?
Yeah. So as a reservist and getting elected to Congress, one of the things we looked into is fulfilling my reserve obligations and keeping my hands in medicine because I had to give up my practice. And so one of the options was at Walter Reed. And they embraced me fully. Matter of fact, one of the first weekends I was in Congress, the chief of orthopedics called and said, hey, we've got a lot of wounded coming back through the weekend. Can you stay? I said, you better believe it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I went in. Well, that slowed down. And so now what I do is if we come in session on a Monday night, I'll spend all day Monday there and I'll take the time to scrub in and go through the case reviews with the residents and work with the residents as well. So it's keeping my hand in it there. But since my most recent promotion a couple of years ago to colonel, I took a job as medical policy advisor for the chief of the Army Reserve. Mm-hmm. And that's been very fulfilling because you have a lot of active duty people dealing with reserve issues, but no one who's actually been a reserve physician mm-hmm. that is living that dual life. Yeah. So it's been able to give me an opportunity to put more input there.
You're no longer practicing. You practice back here in Cincinnati, right?
Correct.
You've retired from that, or
you have to. Basically, they make it pretty impossible. You couldn't make enough to even pay your malpractice in most cases.
Okay.
So this way, I'm under the military, and actually, I'm able to do some time at UC because UC has a component with the Air Force, so there's a military attachment there. Mm-hmm. So I keep some privileging there, but it's the same type of setup where I can do some training there. A couple years ago, I spent 2 weeks there, so I'm in the ER, the OR, and in the clinic, and that's been a good opportunity there, too.
So as we're on your medical career, what made you want to go into podiatry?
Ah, good question. So I knew I wanted to be a physician. I worked in an emergency room in college at Mercy Hospital. And I also worked in the summers up in Michigan. There was a doctor there. It was 4 summers and the same people came every year pretty much. Mm-hmm. And so you get to know them. And one doc said, if you ever want to see what I do, you can come visit me in Michigan. And went to his practice. He was a podiatrist. And I saw people leaving saying, oh, thank you. I feel so much better. Oh, you fixed this. And I went to surgery with him. I said, that looks like a pretty good career. And then I read an article that said there would be an excess of physicians, all physicians, by 1990, except podiatrists. And I said, okay, well, here we go. Let's take a look mm-hmm. at that. And that's how I went into it. And been a great career. Helped a lot of people and started with my own practice and then joined Wellington Orthopedics with 20 some other docs.
So when you're a combat surgeon, are you only specifically doing certain types of surgery or can you, are you like, can you do any kind
of surgery? Well, it's all hands on deck basically, but you, in our arrangement, there was me, an orthopedic surgeon and a general surgeon.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we all participate. You know, whether you're assisting or whatever. Sometimes a general surgeon would assist me with an amputation or putting on an external fixator device on a mm-hmm. fractured leg or something like that, right? So we would help each other out. And say we're doing a case, an abdominal case, we're in the belly and you've got 2 more waiting. You know, I'd say to the general surgeon, okay, I'll close, I'll finish up, and you can get started on the next patient. And so, and same with the orthopedic surgeon. And sometimes it would be all 3 of us on one patient because there were so many wounds and injuries that we would take care of.
You were talking a few years ago when the shooting on the baseball field happened about how, you know, it felt like you were back in the combat doing that again. Can you just, I know you've probably talked about this a lot, and what is that moment like when that happens and you jump in and, you know, you're credited with saving Steve Scalise's life? I mean, what is that moment like and what did you take from that going forward? Did that change your view of anything when that happened?
One, I was grateful for my military experience because it kept me very calm. 2, I was also very grateful that I had changed my mind from going to the outfield and went down to the batting cage, which put me in the best position I could possibly be in because I could see Steve Scalise. I could see the shooter. I could see where all the players were going, diving into the dugout. I could see where the Capitol Police were. I had to move once when the shooter came and started shooting down my lane. But it was just very instinctive to me. And all that was on my mind is really my military training. Get yourself in a safe position. Don't put yourself in harm's way because then you can't help anybody. But also be ready to act when you can. And how can I get to Steve as quickly as possible? And then, you know, I give a lecture now to medical groups. They say, you know, what do you do when you find yourself in a situation like this, whether it's an industrial accident, whatever the case may be, what do you do when you have nothing? You know, we later had that train wreck where we were able to save that one young man because he probably would have drowned in his own blood. Hmm. So what do you do when you have nothing is the idea. But really, it was more 2 days later, I think, when it just hit me like, why did I not go to the outfield? Mm-hmm. Why, you know, I think God did that, right? Because mm-hmm. I don't even like that batting cage that well. It's kind of wild, but I decided to do that and just was lucky to be in the right position. You know, I thank God for the Capitol Police and the Alexandria Police who came in at the end of that. You know, I think that we were blessed in so many ways that day. And Steve Scalise, he wrote a book called Back in the Game. And really, his book is about his faith and divine intervention, how everything had to go right. Mm-hmm. I mean, and usually I leave early. And that day I could stay. Mm-hmm. The groundskeeper locked the third base gate the night before, which is where he started shooting from. And if he could have walked through there, he could have had, you know, 10, 15 people, maybe 20, before Capitol Police could even respond to him. So a lot of things happened that day that were miracles in the long run. And, you know, when the helicopter picked him up, I was told it was a helicopter that was already in air returning from another flight. So that saved time. Everything was about time. So the other thing about his book is it tells you how lucky we are with the medical system we have in our country, our 911 system, and the type of care that we can get. And a lot of that's brought back from the military.
With the state, I mean, with things that cause these types of events, did you view differently being out in public and going out more often?
Sure.
Do you view things differently now than you did the day before that?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we get threats and, you know, we've had Secret Service go to two people's home in the district. You know, I remember going into one event where I knew somebody who had been harassing us on Facebook, and that was going to be at this event. It was an event to give a 96-year-old a Purple Heart from World War II, and yet we had to worry. And fortunately, nothing happened. But you're walking in with your wife and son for this event thinking, oh, man, I hope nothing happens. But we alerted police, and police knew who the individual was and made sure they were very nearby. We've been accosted during parades, and we have undercover with us, and they intervene politely and did a very nice job in one particular instance. So, you know, things do change, and you're more aware that you have to be aware.
Is that worse today than it was in 20, you were first elected in 2012, right? Mm-hmm. Than it was in 2012 when you first went to Congress?
Yes, it is. I think it is. You know, there's a lot of voices we never heard from until the president got elected, to be honest with you. You know, I think that got people going in direction. And, you know, there's a lot of division right now that I hate to see because I believe in one nation under God, and we've got more in common than we don't. And I hope that, you know, I just try and set an example is what I try to do of bringing people together.
Do you blame the president?
No. No, I think these things were
pretty loaded question.
I think these things were,
to be transparent.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's fair to blame someone else for your behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think we do that too much as a society. Now, why that person makes a decision to behave the way they do, we could maybe take a look at that.
Sure.
But to blame one person for, well, that person drove you to it or something like that, I think that's pretty hard, especially when what you're talking about is politics. And that's what I think is a shame, you know?
I want to jump back. Mixing your professional career with politics a little bit. A few years ago, you guys addressed in Congress physician-assisted suicide. That is an issue really kind of near to your heart. Mm-hmm. And you've told me a story about why that is kind of a personal issue for you that takes you back to your days in residency in the mid 80s. Can you talk about that story and why?
Yeah, it's a story and it gets me choked up, but you know, here I am, you know, in a residency, I'm 26 years old or so. And we were responsible, this is in Chicago, responsible for doing the physicals on everyone admitted to the hospital, mm-hmm. regardless of what they were admitted for. And this is 1985, 86. And one of the attending docs came up to us, we're four residents, and he said, well, we just admitted our first AIDS patient, but you don't have to go do the physical. And that just didn't set right with me. And I said, I'm going to go do it. I looked at the other guys and said, I'm going to do it. But you had to go in like a lunar landing. Everyone was scared. No one knew why the people were dying. This was a great unknown in so many ways, right? We're just figuring some things out. And, you know, I went in and I learned so much from this one patient because he had so many things wrong. You know, he had one lung that no longer was working. Organs were enlarged. You could just go on and on and on with how much I learned. And I tell the story that how I learned so much more from what he said to me at the end when he looked at me in a very meek voice and he said, you just examined me more than anyone. And it just gave me a chill. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what does that feel like to just be cast aside where no one will touch you? No one wants to even go near you. And look at how I even have to dress for this. But we didn't know. I mean, that's a common healthcare precaution, but we didn't know. But what does that feel like for him? And the story got even deeper when he died the next day. When he died the next day, and I thought to myself, especially in light of physician-assisted suicide, what did this man bring to me on his last day of life? How valuable was that to me? And the message it sent to me that made me a better doctor throughout my entire career to treat everyone with dignity, no matter what is going on, because of what I saw with him. And if he had taken his life sooner, because, you know, at that time it was a death sentence, I would have never gotten that lesson. We all have something. There's something that can come out of life even to the final moment, in my opinion. And that's what he gave to me. And I had 1,000 or so physicals I did during my residency. That's the only name I remember.
What was his name?
I don't want to say his name publicly, you know, but but I do. Terry, I'll tell you his first name. Okay. I remember his name. And that's how much that meant to me. And so... a very interesting story, and boy, look at where we are today and the advances that we've made in so many ways. But what a lesson he was able to give me on his last day of life.
Yeah, that's me. That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's a cool story.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you again for coming in to join us here. It's been great. It's funny. People always say, write your congressman. Does that work?
Oh, it does. No, it does. Advocacy works. And that's a good message to get out. You know, don't necessarily call and just yell at the staff, if you don't like, but positive or negative. You know, it's been interesting that there's some proposals to change some of the things of Medicare. And I got something in the mail to tell me to write me. But it also said that I am defending this cause, which was good because some of them go out and say, well, looks like it makes it look like I'm against that, but I'm actually for that and I'm fighting with them for that. But the message may not be so clear there. But when people call, we tally how many people are calling on a certain topic, how many people write on a certain topic. We get 277 pieces of mail on average a day.
Wow.
It's a lot to handle. You know, so I apologize to people if sometimes you don't get your response immediately, because we do try to see how many come in under that and try to address the same topic with one letter, if you will. And some of them I get personal with. It depends on the situation.
Yeah.
But that's how we do it.
Yeah. I'd just say make Andrew do it. Shout out to Andrew McAfee on your staff.
How many people are on your staff?
We have a total between here in the district and in DC, there's about 18. Yeah. So we have district director and then district staff. We have two offices in the district, one in Adams County and Peebles, and then the other out on Beachmont.
Okay.
And then in the office in DC is where most of the staff is, because we divide up the work. You know, somebody works on healthcare, somebody else on veterans, somebody else on taxes, things like that. We divide up this expertise.
Yeah.
Well, we have time for one fun question.
I know you're going to always push. Hey, this is what happens every single time we interview anyone, is as soon as he senses that I'm trying to wrap it up because we're getting to the end of time, he likes to throw in another question that I will like undoubtedly send that person off onto a story.
Because, a fun question.
Oh, okay. Well, you need to give a 2-minute warning. Maybe that's what that was. I don't know.
He knows what it was.
That's my cue to ask him to get my fun question ready. Usually my fun question is, what is your favorite Cincinnati restaurant? But I'll switch it up. Are you going to go to opening day?
We are in session that day.
Oh.
And it should be a flyout day. And the game's at 4:30, if possible. But I have to check because I believe we are driving back.
Do you usually go to opening day?
If I have before in town. Yeah. Yeah.
What's your favorite annual Cincinnati event? Well, we're talking about opening day. And I mean,
well, they've changed over time. You know, when I was younger and single, I used to like Oktoberfest and some of those pretty well. It was a great gathering. You know, baseball, I've been a baseball fan my whole life. I mean, I had a crystal radio when I was a kid so that it was powerless, right? And you could hear it. The only station you could get was WLW. So I could listen to Dodger Reds games late at night and my dad didn't have to turn off the radio. Mm. So really it's getting to baseball game. I got great memories of my dad with Crosley Field and Riverfront Stadium.
Yeah.
And now I want to do the same thing with my son. Opening day, I do enjoy that a lot when I can get to it.
Have you gone to an FC game yet?
I have not,
Cincinnati?
Actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Shame on me. Well, there's not room.
I know there's no room
anymore. So what is your favorite restaurant here in the city? Do you have one that sticks out?
I don't really have one in particular. I don't want to nab one over the other, actually. But I, you know, I've always liked, like a Trio's very good. Montgomery Inn is a, you know, one we always like to go to, but at the same time, we like little Eli's down on Eastern
there
Avenue.
Nice.
Yeah.
There are plenty to choose
house
from.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's close.
That's awesome. Well, thank you again for coming to join us, Brad. It was great to have you here, and thank you for all your work you do for people here and all the way from here all the way to Portsmouth and everything down DC. Enjoy those drives.
And
8 hours with two kids under five, that you are a trooper.
And I can't forget Precinct either, because that's right down the hill, and we love that too.
Right down the hill in Columbia, Tuscaloosa.
Now, affordability, you know, we can't, you know, we love getting there. That's a special one.
You have to, I always say, you have to get a promotion or fall into money somehow to be like, all right, I'm going to the Precinct, right? Anytime you get a promotion, boom. Got to go to the Precinct.
All about it.
Absolutely.
Thanks
you again, Brad, for joining us. Much thanks to Brad Wenstrup for joining us. You know, I feel like you see politicians and people like kind of turn away, like politics, and they're screaming and yelling at each other in Washington, and it's divisive, and it's Trump, and it's all this stuff. Man, the backstory behind someone like Brad Wenstrup is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Like the stories he was telling, and like I thought the one of the most interesting things he said was he recommends to anybody that wants to get into politics to do something, anything else first. Yeah. I wish more politicians heeded that advice, and you did see more people with that understand how the real world works and create some sort of a background before they get into it. But it's just, man, just a fascinating story. And much thanks again to him for coming through.
Absolutely. The system wasn't set up necessarily for you to make a career out of it.
No,
it's a system that is set up to get everyday people elected, which that's how it was originally set up, but it's obviously become a not that, and whoever's wealthy and special interests and all that stuff's involved. But you know, politics aside, I'm glad we didn't dive into politics, which we're trying to intentionally stay away from. When we do have an elected official on, for the most part, we want to show sort of a human side of them. And I'm just fascinated by Congressman Winstrup's background and some of the things that he's done, you know, away from Capitol Hill. And I really appreciate him sharing that stuff.
You know what? You think it's tough to deal with people in Washington and everything that goes along. He's got a staff of almost 20 people. You know what's harder than that? Being a 60-year-old dude with a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old. He's in, you know, the podcast, you can't tell, he's in great shape.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a lot.
I'm a 43 with a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old, and it's about all I can handle.
You need a nap.
So do I.
A lot.
I need that a lot too. Anyways, thanks again to Brad Wenster for coming on. Reminder: next week on the podcast, it's opening day week, so we are going to have Karen Forgas from the Reds, who. You don't know about Karen, does incredible work. She's really the spirit of their connection with the community over there behind the scenes. And
looking forward to that
big time. All I say is she is as interesting as a person as you will find, and true Cincinnati. And there, you really can't get a better time to have her on than next week with opening day on Thursday. So we'll have Karen Forgas next week. Really looking forward to her coming on as our guest. Reminder to everybody, if you have thoughts on people that you want us to have on, if you have thoughts on topics you'd like us to talk about, heck, maybe you know somebody who you're like, this person is Cincinnati to their core, you should have them on as your guest. Let us know. Send us an email. Hit us up on Twitter. Jason, where can people email you at?
jwilliams@inquirer.com.
jwilliams@inquirer.com. Or jwilliamscincy on Twitter.
C-I-N-C-Y. Which you don't like.
You can hit me. I don't. I'm an eye guy. But at Paul Daner Jr., you can hit me up on Twitter as well. I will hopefully you won't get lost in the Bengals vitriol that shows up on my mentions. But
new day.
But anyway, so there is a please let us know. Get to us. We always love hearing from you on different topics. All right, time for the That's So Cincinnati.
So Cincinnati.
Ooh, there it is, that's Phil. Smooth. My man Phil Didion on the ones and twos. I got one. So on Saturday was a pretty nice day. Like the weather finally broke a little bit.
Finally
broke a little bit. So myself, my wife, my daughter, who's about to turn two here in the next couple of months, we went to Lunken Airport and at their restaurant, the Sky Galley. Have you been to this place?
I've never eaten there. I've actually been in there for an event, but I've never eaten there.
I gotta tell you. Pretty cool. I don't know if I'm a loser. Well, I mean, I know that, but I'm if I'm a big enough loser that I just found it really cool watching the planes take off and come in and whatever the people that are, you know, going out on these little tiny planes.
Lunken's a neat place.
Yeah, it was a cool thing to watch. You can sit there, you know, you can sit right there at the window. You can watch the planes go up and come down. You know, my daughter thinks it's the coolest thing ever, you know, saying bye-bye to all the planes and like watching them come in. Yeah, I mean, you know, it is. It was entertaining. You know, if you have a kid, you know the value of being entertained while also being outside of your house.
Absolutely.
That is invaluable. It's worth gold nuggets. I loved it. I thought it was really cool. And so I thought this is a So Cincinnati moment right here of going to Lunken Airport, Cincinnati. Watching the planes.
So Cincinnati.
That's right. So that's my So Cincinnati moment of the week. Shout out to everybody. I gotta say I just thought it was a cool little spot. And if you haven't been, go down there, check it out. It's a fun thing to do on an afternoon and watch everybody go out there and.
Were you the only people eating there?
No, it wasn't packed.
Yeah.
I've actually heard that about the place, is that it's kind of notoriously not super crowded, which is kind of cool, you know, where it's...
You got a review of the food?
Oh, you know, here I am now telling everyone about it, so maybe that'll change anything, although I'm not quite Polly Campbell where I can affect things like that.
Do you have a Polly-esque review of the Sky Galley?
I can't really give a true review because I only had a couple of appetizers.
Oh, okay.
The beer cheese was good with the pretzels. I'll say that.
You're going to stick with the positive?
I'm going to stick with the positive. I haven't had any of the real food. They had a very full menu, but all I had was a couple of appetizers, so I can't really speak to that. Do you have one this week?
I do. Right, this actually comes from an email from this is a friend of mine who's also a very loyal subscriber to Cincinnati.com and a reader. And he's a season ticket holder. He claims to be the first season ticket holder, and I believe the club acknowledges him as that for FC Cincinnati.
Really?
Matthew Long.
Oh, man.
Our man P. did on the ones and twos. What does that mean, ones and twos?
Like the wheels of steel, the records.
Oh, okay.
Anyway. Come on, where's your street cred, Richard Marks?
Yeah, exactly. So Matthew emailed me, and he said his email was in the 80th minute, in a 90 minute obviously soccer match, in the 80th minute, FC Cincinnati of their first ever home MLS game. Game. He says, 3-0, the home team is up, and people are leaving in droves with still 10 minutes left in the 10 minutes plus left in the match.
Yeah.
And he says, that's so Cincinnati.
So Cincinnati.
It is. It really is. We will all say this. Have you ever tried to get out of Clifton after a big event or during a big event? That is a special like layer of hell to be a part of. Trying to get out of one of those garages.
But I mean, that's history. That's the first ever home MLS game. Don't you want to stay to the end?
You know what else is history? The hour and a half of your life you will never get back trying to get out of a garage while 35,000 people all try to exit Clifton at the same time.
Who's their curmudgeon here?
I don't care. You can call me a curmudgeon. I've been in that traffic far too often.
A curmudgeon thing to leave the game early and complain about getting out of the garage.
Did I say I would leave early? I'm not saying that. Okay. I'm saying I sympathize with those that are trying to avoid the Clifton crush. No. That's all I'm saying about that.
Just wait it out. Yeah, it's a Sunday. It's a Sunday afternoon. It was sunny. It was beautiful. It was Cincinnati sports history. I don't know. Just take it in and savor it and enjoy it. We need to learn to enjoy things around here.
You're right. How about a sports day for the ages on Sunday? Not for the ages, but a pretty good one.
A rare good sports day.
You know, the Bengals re-signed Eifert on Saturday. That didn't make too many people mad.
That's right.
And then the next day, UC wins the ACC tournament and by beating Houston for the first time. And then the MLS FC gets the MLS win. I mean, the Reds are like, you know, Reds are wearing the green hats for our man John Fay down in Goodyear. Everything was just right for Cincinnati sports, which only, you know, that means what the immediate thought that everyone has while that's happening in this city is, okay, well, what that means, it's going to get real bad soon.
Yeah. And the FC Cincy was, I mean, sold out crowd, 3-0. Sorry, not 3-0. 3-0.
3-0 for the lads.
Victory. On the pitch.
On the pitch.
Wearing their kits.
You got all the keywords in. You're all over it. But yeah, so yeah, congrats to them. I mean, that was a big day for them. It's cool to see the turnout and everything happened on the field was just kind of cherry on top stuff. What else do you got going on in the paper right now? I know you have Cincinnati.com right now. People can read your story. You had a really interesting one today.
Yeah, it was not nice to kind of get away and write about, human beings. And I try to mix that in at times when you're mixing in some of the watchdog stuff and accountability. I like to tell people but just write about the human side of politicians sometimes. And this was the case today is that a guy, Matt Wallert, who is running for township trustee in Colerain Township, a really good guy. Very well liked. I got text messages from Democrats saying he is a Republican, saying they really like him, and he's just a nice guy. But anyway, he decided he needs to get healthy, and he decided that as a part of his campaign, and he was going to promise to lose 150 pounds, and he felt like, hey, it's a challenge to. It's a promise that, I'm going to deliver on this promise to show people that, hey, I would deliver on a huge promise like that if I were elected to office. Gimmicky, whatever, but this guy is committing himself to getting healthy and, going to the MMA gym in Oakley 3 times a week and changing his diet. And we just had the death of the Boone County clerk Kenny Brown, and he said this Matt Wallert said that he was motivated. Kenny Brown, I've seen pictures of him, but from what I've heard, really struggled with his weight, and Matt Wallert said this was something that helped motivate him to get going, and he's already down 16 pounds a couple weeks into his training regimen and on his way to 150. I don't care if he wins. I don't know anything about the race itself. I don't care if he wins or loses that. But I'm certainly rooting for him to and his journey to get healthy.
Yeah, no, that kind of stuff is great, and man, it's a huge issue that people need to be tackling anyway. So even just bringing light to that, I think is a big deal for sure.
And hopefully, you know, we talked last Thursday, and he was like, "Hey, I'm being really vulnerable here," and he did not want to share how much he weighed in my column. But he let me know, like, he's trying to lose 150 pounds. And, he was really concerned about how social media was going to react. And I just said, well, that's, you can't control, that's whatever. I said, to me, this is an encouraging thing, and I hope people will see the peace and, be encouraged by it and being, you know, encourage him as well.
Social media is always going to react some way. Outrage of the day is inevitable.
Yep.
All right, so Cincinnati.com, keep it locked in there for pieces like that from Jason. Of course, I know there'll be more coming from you. You can, Bengals news is still hot off the presses these days. The free agency is still going on, and people are still mad about stuff. So you can keep all that there. Next week, opening day, our Reds reporters will finally return from their winter hibernation in Goodyear. Bobby Nightingale, Faye Man, everybody will be back. March Madness going on, so lots of
fun time of year.
Yeah, it is. I really enjoy March into April is one of the best times of year for sure for sports here locally. Being a college basketball town, I always like it. Do you go anywhere for March Madness? Like, are you a go to the bar and watch games? Are you a bracket guy? Like, do you
nope.
No, you don't even do one bracket.
Nope.
That is so predictable that you would be I don't even do a bracket.
I just I don't have kids
with their brackets.
I have this weird thing, like, I just never put money on sports, or have never. I know.
Wow.
I know it's something. It's just
I cannot
a fun thing.
Associate with that.
I just I just want to enjoy sports. I don't want to be a part of
that. Helps you enjoy sports.
It
Jason.
Does. Oh.
You should want to gamble on sports because you'll be amazed at how much more you enjoy it.
Who does? To be honest, yeah. It's certainly a huge money maker. And
I'm a one bracket guy, though. I'm one sheet of integrity.
Is that what you call it, the sheet of integrity?
Well, I'm kind of stealing from Mike and Mike. They used to talk about that.
How much is your to buy in to get
into
your
school? Oh, it's just a little $10 or whatever.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I'm actually in a CBI pool where I got 16 people to get together.
That's hilarious.
And everyone gets one of the horses in the CBI. But the funniest part about that is not the fact that you're rooting for, like, Cal Baptist or Cal State Northridge or one of these schools you've never even heard of. It's, okay, I'm interested in this now because I have something on the line.
Right.
How do I watch this? So you're trying to go to, like, obscure conference streaming services.
And,
like,
BN Sports.
Do I buy the Conference USA streaming package for the year just so I can watch this one CBI semifinal?
What does it say more? College Basketball
Invitational.
Oh, Invitational.
Yeah, I think Invitational. But yeah, so... So it's pretty sad, but it's so weak it's strong, as we
would
say.
What about an NIT pool? Do you do that?
They're too strong. Oh, they're in the middle. Strong. That's no fun. The NCAA, super strong. CBI, so weak it's strong.
And there's even another tournament too. The CIT.
Oh yeah, Insiders Tournament. That's too far down.
The only reason why I know about it is because the Marshall Thunder Herd are playing in it.
Oh, are they?
You know, the CBI and the CIT, the schools actually have to pay to play in them. It's like a $30,000 buy-in to get.
You know who's
game.
In the CBI this year?
West Virginia Mountain
Hugs.
They were terrible this year.
Dude, what is Huggy doing in that tournament? Like, just be like, dude, I'm just gonna call it quits, man. What are you doing?
Really want to try to get more experience for his young players, because I can't see Hugs wanting to play in anything other than the NCAA tournament.
Maybe he just loves New York and he's just hoping to get there for the.
Is that where the championship is?
Yeah, and it's and I actually like it. They do best 2 out of 3 for the final.
Oh, a series, okay.
Yeah, I like this. I like the idea of a series. I've always thought it would be fun if the NCAA could come up with a way to add a series element to the tournament. So, like, the first round, let's say the first round games, maybe those are just one and done. Or you could have a series where if you win by 20. Then you're done after one game and it's over. But if the other team keeps it within 20, they get a shot at a second game or something like that, and you turn it into series.
Interesting.
I just feel like basketball. I know that's the fun of the tournament.
You have the NBA. I mean, the NBA playoffs are series.
Yeah, but and the NBA almost always gets the best teams at the end, and I understand that's the fun of the NCAA tournament is, you know, your George Masons, your Loyolas, your all these teams that make Cinderella runs. But anyway, enjoy all of your tournament watching this week, everybody. It's one of the better weekends of the year. Go to a bar, have a couple of drinks, enjoy some hoops, some revelry, support local businesses. Don't go to the national chains.
Drink local beer.
Drink local beer. We're all about local here because we're so Cincinnati.
We are so Cincinnati.
So Cincinnati.
Boom. There it is. On that note, reminder everybody, so next week, Karen Forgas from the Cincinnati Reds is going to be our guest. Look forward to that. So come on back next week. Thank you to everybody that has been listening and keeping up with the podcast. If you like it, please tell your friends. Please go on iTunes and give us a review. Right? It helps us stay alive. But we've been love seeing our numbers have been going up, and it's been great to see that everybody's getting on board with the podcast.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, everybody, for listening. And if you have ideas, topics, you know somebody that you think should be a guest on our show, let us know. Email Jason, jwilliams@inquirer.com, or hit us up on Twitter at @PaulineJr, @JWilliamsCincy, with a Y, sadly, on Twitter. And we'll see what we can do. Anyway, thank you, everybody, for listening, and we will talk to you next week on That's a Cincinnati.